This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go.
Good. That's so good to hear your voice.
Aw, it's good to hear yours.
All right, so we'll get into our intro. So I'm here with the wonderful, the delightful, ooh, the gorgeous,
oh,
who hates me complimenting her.
I love it.
It's Annie Harris herself.
Hi.
Live, hello. And in stereo.
Hi.
So today we're talking all about student mental health. So first off, let's start with a few stats. So these stats are from YouGov and are all specifically around mental health in university students. More than a quarter of students, so 27%, report having a mental health problem of one type or another.
Yeah, I think that, well, that correlates pretty well with the statistics from Mind, that one in four of us will live a mental health condition or experience a mental health condition in some way, mm-hmm, in one way or another. You would think that it would be higher because university is like a time of stress, but also at the same time, there's lots of different periods in life that are stressful, you know, moving house or having a baby or children leaving home or divorce or whatever. So I'm not surprised by that at all.
Yeah. And I think having gone to uni myself, I wouldn't have realized at the time it was that high.
Yeah.
You know, I felt a lot more isolated in what I was going through.
I was just about to say the same thing. I felt like the one with the mental health problems, you know?
Yeah, that was your sticker.
The crazy one. The mental one, I should say. A bit more on brand.
Yeah. So another stat I found really interesting was depression and anxiety are by far the most common reported mental health ailments. Of those who suffer, 77% have depression-related problems and 74% have anxiety-related problems. So mm-hmm, those percentages are percentages of all the people in the studies that went into these facts.
Yeah.
Had one condition or the other. That, I think, is particularly relevant for this episode because when talking to Jenny, her initial diagnosis was anxiety and depression.
Sure.
And so that's such a common combination anyway. They're such common individual mental illnesses as well. It's sure, interesting that in specifically students, there seems to be a higher level of crossover.
It's nice to find a statistic that solidifies the existence of depression and anxiety together, because I remember when I was sort of seeking a lot of my initial diagnoses, I was like, oh, I didn't realize that. Well, I thought that depression and anxiety came together, but the information that I originally found online when I was looking up about 10 years ago implied that they were very much separate. So it's really refreshing to find that style of, well, that communication around the two of them as a terrible, horrible partnership has improved in the last 10 years for sure.
I love the way you've described it as a terrible, horrible partnership.
Yeah, I was just saying partnership, and then I was like, that's not what I want to say. Like,
well, I'm just imagining them like these two like shadowy masked figures that are conspiring against you.
You know what they remind me of is the Marge Simpson sisters in The Simpsons, Patty and Selma,
yeah,
that are just there with the cigarettes, like, ah, oh, we're gonna get inside your brain, like. These horrible little twins.
Love it. We'll get into shortly the episode with Jenny Pusey. I found this episode incredibly moving. She has so much insight to share, hence why this is our longest episode ever. Ooh. But there's quite a lot of things we get into, not just around student mental health. There is also quite a bit of conversation about self-harm. So that's a quick disclaimer there if that's something you might want to skip over or maybe just miss this episode if that's something that may affect you negatively listening to that. Also, we talk a little bit about, with her being a medical student, we talk a little bit about the NHS and the kind of diagnosis model and the kind of pros and cons of how diagnoses work. and the necessity of having one to access certain treatments. But before we get into that, I wanted to also share a little bit of what makes this topic something I'm so passionate about. You know, I wanted from day one to have an episode on student mental health because that's when my mental health experience started. For contrast, Annie, before I get into that, do you have anything you want to add on?
Yeah, when you were talking there, I was just thinking a lot about when you go away to university, it's such a formative time of your life. Like, it's the first time you leave the nest, the first time, well, for a lot of people, it's the first time they leave the nest. It's the first time that you're learning to fend for yourself. And it's the first time that you're really starting to feel like an independent person and sort of learning more about yourself and learning more about the way that the world works around you and how other people work, you know, in relation to that. So I think that an episode on student mental health is so crucial right now, not just because it's September, but just because the conversation around mental health is growing so amazingly. And people need to know that it's okay to feel scared or frightened or overwhelmed, particularly when they move away for the first time, that I think it's so important that people are getting the support that they need. And that's why I'm really thrilled that we've had Jenny on the podcast, because the work that she's doing sounds absolutely amazing.
Absolutely. And she is a great example of where she has just returned to university. So we'll get into that in the episode as well, that she's had some time out. She's managed to take the time for herself to get the support that she really needed. And as a result, has now gone back to university and is back on the kind of the path that she really wants to be on. And so that's a really nice and positive thing. Hopefully the episode ends on. In contrast, my experience of university was I had a positive outcome for different reasons. So unlike Jenny, I never wanted to go to university. It wasn't that I had anything particularly against it. I just knew that wasn't the path for me. I have dyslexia, so partly because of that, I'm not the most naturally academic. I struggled quite a lot in school, and it took me a lot longer than my peers to master even what's considered basic skills, like learning to read, took me twice as long as my peers. And it wasn't until really secondary school that I think I really caught up with where other people were at. And so when I got to sixth form, I loved sixth form. I loved school. I partly loved school more so for the social side than the actual learning. So when I was at sixth form, I got my first job. And so I'd do Monday to Friday there. And then I'd go away to work on the Friday, work the Saturday and the Sunday. And a lot of my peers at the time didn't quite get that. Whereas for me, that was the most free I'd ever felt, because it was the first time I was doing something out of education that I was really excelling in. You know, I really loved it. It was retail work. I was working in Selfridges and I really loved working there. And I made so many friends, and it just was the first time I really felt like a proper adult. You know, I was only earning a part-time wage, but it was more money than I'd ever had before. It just seemed obvious that would be the productive thing I would do with my weekends. You know, I'm a child of two doctors myself, so I can understand, you know, being a workaholic. That's the way I was brought up. You know, it's no coincidence that I work 6-7 days a week now. Not at all. Mm-hmm. And so for me, uni never really seemed an option. I was in fact counting down the days to leave sixth form and just go into work and, you know, start working towards working for myself like I do now. My family had a different idea, and my school had a different idea. So interestingly, the same as Jenny, both of the schools we went to, it was very much driven towards uni as the thing you do after school.
Mm-hmm.
I never was talked to about, you know, work. I was never taught about, you know, going to a job interview or anything like that, which to me seemed like basic life skills. But instead, it was all geared towards university and nothing else, not apprenticeships, not going into the workplace, not building up skills in other forms of education. It was just all geared towards uni. And so I very much applied for uni as something we did. We had set PSHE sessions and form time where we would apply for uni as a group. And so I just did it because that's what we were doing. That was what the lesson was for. And I fully never expected to go. A good way to illustrate that is the unis I applied for. The two that I think I ended up getting into were Aberystwyth and Bangor University. So you can tell I was just going through the alphabet of which ones might I get through.
Aaron A. Aronson University.
Yeah, so, and I actually didn't even get the grades for them in the end. Bangor let me in, I think, 40 UCAS points less, which I think is about 2 grades less than I should have had.
Wow.
Still at that point, I fully never expected to go. I'd applied for a deferred year. At no point I expected to go to university. However, school was really keen I did. Even in the, weirdly, even in the yearbook, it said which uni I was going to. That they just lifted. I'd never actually made that decision. They just lifted it from my information. And my parents both went to uni themselves. It was sort of what was expected of me. Without going into that too much, I got to a point where it was coming to the end of the third year, and I was working for myself, and I was also still working in Selfridges, and I had, you know, loads of great friends, and I was just really enjoying my first proper taste of adult life. It wasn't that that wasn't tough, but I wanted to be there. You know, that's what, that very much felt my path. Increasingly, as my potential uni start date drew near, it became more and more obvious that I didn't have a choice. It was sort of never said, but felt very much implied that I had to do that to earn my keep.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my parents saying phrases like, "You're in this house because we're paying for it. You know, we're feeding you. We're keeping a roof over your head." And it really felt very much implied at the time that this is what you do to earn that. You don't get to stay here for free. Despite the fact that I was working and I wasn't just freeloading and sitting around at home. But, you know, we would have conversations that increasingly felt like ambushes, where I would come home from a long day and they'd be waiting for me to have another chat. And it was always the same things. And it was always an argument that went in many ways kind of over my head, because it was really standard prospectus rhetoric of, "This will broaden your horizons. How do you know you won't like it if you've not tried it?" To which I would logically answer something like, "Well, I've done school. I've been in education for most of my life. And based on that experience, I don't think any more is the best path for me. That's not where I excel. I love working. I can excel in work. And I can see a future for me there. I don't think I have anything to offer in university." And actually, I didn't really believe I'd come out with anything. I didn't think I'd learn stuff that would be truly relevant to my path. You know, there's not a degree for being an entrepreneur. There's not a degree for being self-employed. However, I was learning so much out here in what I call the real world. And I felt like that was all falling on deaf ears, that I actually knew what I wanted to do. And I've always felt really lucky in having an idea of what I want to do when so many people I know don't. And then it felt like that path that I was on and where I wanted to be was being taken away from me for logic that I just thought was flawed, you know. And there was no way for me to phrase it. You know, I could say to my parents, "Well, I've not tried skydiving. I'm pretty confident I wouldn't like that." And they'd say I was being ridiculous. But, you know, I was just desperately trying to explain. It wasn't working. And increasingly, we'd have more and more conversations like that. And it didn't matter if I was in tears during them.
Yeah.
At the very most, my parents would pause and regroup and then continue. I felt incredibly lonely despite living with three other people. So fast forwarding, I found myself being dropped off in Bangor University, which is a little, it's technically a city, but it feels more like a town. The whole thing was just surreal. I didn't know what I was doing there. I knew just about where my dorm was, but I didn't really know much at all. So I just kind of rocked up and just followed the crowds and settled in as best I could. And, you know, when my family left, having dropped me off, I remember just wandering round Bangor. And I didn't even realize it, but the whole, it's the weirdest thing. The city is like a big loop. You go out in one direction, you just come back on yourself. So it was almost like a metaphor for me not being able to escape. And I remember phoning a good friend of mine and just having a conversation with her down the phone of, why am I here? How did this happen? Where the fuck am I? And I remember distinctly, I was, you know, just walking around in circles, trying to get my head around all of this, feeling really lost. And I walked past the same three people three times. And each time I walked past them, they seemed to get like increasingly perturbed in their face of why I was just walking in circles. But, you know, it felt instantly like I'd been taken away from my whole support system. And I was in a place I never wanted to be. And I'd had to quit my job that I loved. And I'd had to mostly dissolve the business that I'd started. And, you know, all my purpose that I'd built up was then gone, and I was somewhere I never wanted to be. And I honestly didn't think I would ever get more than a 2-2 anyway, if not a third.
I think, like, regardless of your situation or whatever your situation is going into university, even though your story is very specific to you and obviously very personal, because how, what else can it be? I think a lot of people can relate to these feelings of being taken away from their support system, being taken away from the things that they know. I think it's something that we can all relate to. Like, I really wanted to go to university, but I still felt those feelings.
Absolutely. And I don't want it to come across at all like I blame my parents, because, you know, that's what they know. You know, university is an integral part of becoming a doctor. It wasn't an option for them. But it really did feel like an option for me, but an option that they couldn't see.
Yeah.
You know, much like school, they didn't see an alternative, even though I was already living the alternative. I did try. You know, I went to all the lectures initially. I didn't go to all the lectures for very long. I can't actually tell you what degree I studied, which I think represents how out of it I was. It was something to do with business or marketing, something like that. I couldn't tell you the name of the course. But, you know, I went and I was surrounded by people that were really excited to be there. What was a real godsend for me was one of my flatmates was returning to education after a few years out and had been working in retail for most of that time. And so that was so valuable looking back to have someone that was in a similar position to me. Most of the people at the uni were younger than me and had come straight from school, hadn't ever worked, and were on a very different thinking to me. They wanted to just be there to party and to have a laugh and to get a degree, and I actually just wanted to be home and back to my normal life. And so it wasn't long until my mental health started really deteriorating. There was only so long I could kind of keep up the pretense of, oh, this is novel, I'll give it a go, I don't want to be here, but we'll see what happens. And it wasn't long before I started seeing people less and started leaving the flat less, and all my self-care fell away. I wasn't showering. I remember spending a hell of a lot of time in the dark, just listening to loads of audiobooks because they made me feel less lonely. At the time, I don't think I realised initially it was depression. I had an overwhelming sense of like loneliness and loss it was almost like I was grieving, and it felt like loneliness, yet I didn't want to spend time with other people. Mm-hmm. That really stressed me out. I just wanted to spend time on my own and eat loads of Nutella, and I wasn't really eating much at all. You know, my flatmate that I mentioned that had come back to uni having worked for a few years, we never actually talked about it. I don't ever know. Well, we talked about it after I had a depression diagnosis, but at the time we never discussed if she knew what was going on, but she clearly knew something was up because she used to just like bang on my door, and whether I was awake or not, she'd be like, we're going out, we're going for a meal. And actually, that was such a godsend for her to be there to shake me out of that. And, you know, often her boyfriend would come and visit, and so I'd spend a lot of time with the two of them. And they felt a lot more on the same wavelength as me in terms of, you know, understanding what I wanted to go back to, you know, the work life that I was missing, the home life I was missing. I don't know how much worse I might have got if it wasn't for support like her and friends that came to visit me, and, you know, my parents, once they realised how bad I really was, really was checking up on me a lot. And, you know, that was great in knowing that people cared when a little bit I felt like I'd been kind of shuttled off to the middle of nowhere. We talk a little bit in the episode of like how kind of bad that got. But by the time I got to the GP, I knew that I had depression. I'd looked into it enough. I was just like, this must be it. This must be what's going on. Because I felt so removed from who I actually was. That was possibly the scariest thing. I didn't feel like myself anymore. I just felt like a shell, and I had no answer for it other than getting out of uni. And that's all I wanted. And it became less and less of making the best of it and more of just trying to sleep. You know, I really struggled sleeping and just trying to sleep and just trying to get through the day, not even get through uni, just keep going. It ultimately came down to getting my parents' blessing that I could leave. And all of this happened really fast. Basically, I had a New Year's party, and I remember having an argument with my folks on the way to it, because they were like, you know, we're going to this, it's friends of the family, you get on with them, you're just going to have to, I think, buck up your ideas was the phrase that was used. You're going to have to buck up your ideas and, you know, put on a good face, and we're going to have fun, and it's New Year's. And I just had to, you know, say to them, I can do that. I can put on a brave face and chat and eat and just be relatively normal. But when we leave, I'm still going to be feeling like this. No New Year's party is going to fix this. This is what I'm going through right now. As predicted, we went, and I don't really remember it. I was probably there in my head at the time, but it was fine. And we left, and as soon as we left and I was away from non-family members again, my mood just dropped back down. I wasn't acting anymore. And so instantly I was back to exactly how I felt before. And that's actually when my mum was like, okay, you need to get out. You need to leave uni. You know, and that was it. And so over the Christmas holidays, we went down and took all my stuff away. And my flatmates possibly saw it coming, and they knew that I was hating it there. And I did get out, and I went straight into job hunting and trying to get back to normal as quickly as possible. It really changed everything. I don't know where I would be if I'd stayed. And I know that uni suits so many people, but it was the lowest time I've ever had. And it introduced me to a level of sadness and darkness that I think to some extent I've been running from ever since. Yeah. I know now how bad I can get. And I know that level of depression is still in here. in me somewhere, and I just try and live my life to not go back to that place.
Like, thank you so much for being so candid as well. I think a lot of people out there listening will be really, really grateful to hear a really candid story from you. And I found it really interesting to listen to and super moving. Thank you.
Of course. Well, that's one that I wanted to save for this episode in particular, because it's something that if I tell people about it in my personal life, I normally have to like know that I have 30 minutes to really go into it. So yeah. I could have got into more the how low I really got, but I just wanted to kind of quickly go through that sort of experience, and hopefully it's a useful kind of contrast and context when hearing Jenny's story.
Amazing.
So we'll get into the episode in just a moment, but first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. This is a book that my mum used to read me when I was little, and it's one that I've revisited again as an adult because it's just such a beautiful story. Even in the description, actually, it says it's loved and cherished by adults and children alike. I think even if you've never read it before, it has a kind of nostalgic fairy tale feel to reading it. And whilst it was originally written in French, it's been translated into more than 160 languages. So basically, it's worth at least taking a look at. It's described, in terms of the story, as a pilot stranded in the desert awakens one morning to see, standing before him, the most extraordinary little fellow. "Please," asks the stranger, "draw me a sheep." As the pilot realizes that when life's events are too difficult to understand, there is no choice but to succumb to their mysteries, he pulls out pencil and paper, and thus begins this wise and enchanting fable. So, if you want to give that book a try, or any on Audible, you can get your first book for free with our link, and that's bit.ly/mentalbooks. The details are also in the episode description.
I'm Jenny, and my mental health journey probably started when it was the end of my first year at uni, when I think it was probably a combination of exams coming up, probably just the pressure of having your first year at uni as well, so you're in a new place, learning to like live on your own, and also I think it was the pressure of having the uni lifestyle as well. So I was still trying to like go out every night and kind of make myself have like this really good, perfect like Instagram uni time, I suppose, that you're supposed to have. And then I'd also had a relationship breakup as well just before. And I think everything just all kind of spiraled together. And it was, I'd just sat my exams and I was due to go home, and then I was actually meant to be going away on like a sort of volunteering trip for 4 weeks, but I just like couldn't do it. I just kept like delaying going home, and I don't think I really understood what was going on at the time, because I just had really bad anxiety. I was just really depressed, and I was like having panic attacks, but I didn't understand what they were either. And I remember there was one time where one of my flatmates like was there at the same time. And I just thought that I couldn't breathe. Like, I think it's quite a classic thing of, I was thinking I was having a heart attack or something.
Yeah. It's funny you should say that. Literally every guest that's described a panic attack has said they thought they were having a heart attack.
Yeah, because I just remember I couldn't, like, I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't breathe. Like, my hands started tingling. I just, like, fell to the floor and, like, couldn't get myself to move. So I was totally panicking, thinking that I was literally dying. And it was when the paramedics came that they were saying that it was a panic attack. So it was soon after that that one of my friends took me to my GP. And I literally, I think at this point it got so bad that I just sort of collapsed into the GP's room, just having like a full-blown panic attack. And she sent me straight up to. So, like, Edinburgh's quite good because it has a really big, like, psychiatric hospital, and they have a really good crisis team there. So they saw me. And were kind of happy that I didn't need a meeting, so they sent me kind of back to my GP. But, yeah, I think for that summer, I found it really hard because I didn't want to tell anyone because I felt like it was just something that was, like, wrong with me, and I felt quite embarrassed about it as well. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was having quite a lot of paranoid thoughts as well, so I got it in my head that it's, like, it's so hard to explain looking back on it because it just seems totally ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I got it in my head that the universe was, like, it was, like, my time was up and the universe was gonna, like, assassinate me somehow by... I don't know why it would choose to do it this way, but my two fears were, one, that it would stage it as a public transport crash so I wouldn't get on any buses or anything because I was convinced that if I got on a bus, it would be crashed. Mm-hmm. And the other one was, like, I started getting fixated in, like, certain colours of food because I was just convinced that a particular colour would be poison, so I sort of ended up, like, gradually cutting out colours of food, which doesn't make any sense. When I look back on it now, yeah. It's just, like, no logic to it whatsoever, but I completely...
But at the time, it was really real, and also...
Yeah.
You're saying that this all happened at the end of 1 year, is that right? 1 academic
Yeah.
So that's quite a lot to be going on, particularly when...
Yeah.
You don't have much insight yet, you know, you have a panic attack, you think it's a heart attack. Am I right in thinking you've not experienced, like, anxiety or feelings of depression, anything like that level?
Well, yeah, not at that level. I think it's in hindsight I can look back and realise that I think probably when I was a teenager I would get quite a lot of anxiety, but I, like, again, I didn't know what it was. So, like, around exams and stuff, I would have a lot of periods where I'd feel just generally unwell, and it would just be, like, the vaguest of symptoms, but I would just put it down to having some kind of illness all the time. And it's only in hindsight I can look back and realize that it was always correlated to something that I would have felt anxious about but didn't realize that it was anxiety, if that makes sense.
And so you've got all of this going on, you don't know a huge amount about what's going on with you yet, so it makes complete sense that these new realities are very real for you. You don't have a way to separate them. So you then went into the summer holidays, is that right?
Yeah, so I went into the summer holidays and kind of just pretty much just tried to hide for the whole of summer and just became so, like, withdrawn. I'd started on some, my GP had started me on some medication at this point, but at first I was really afraid of taking the medication as well because I was also quite convinced that it was going to make me ill. Mm-hmm. And so it took... Like, I was cutting it up into the tiniest bits and being like, okay, I'll take a quarter of this tiny tablet at a time. And I was trying to build it up. And it was just, it got to the point where eventually my GP, she was seeing me weekly at this point, and she was really great. But it did get to the point where she was just like, if, like, you can't just take a quarter of a tablet every 2 days. So she kind of got a bit firmer with me and was like, look, if you don't do something, like, we're going to have to think about hospital, which... At the time, I kind of hated her for it, but actually, like, I can see now that I needed someone to be firm with me and to just tell me. I think I just needed someone at that point just to tell me what to do and be like, just take the medication. And it did start to help a little bit.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was well enough to go back to uni in the autumn. But then I think the problem is, as time went on, and again, it kind of came up to around exam time where... It was just before Christmas, and that's probably the first time I just became, like, really unwell and ended up in hospital over Christmas, because at this point as well, I started self-harming and sort of taking overdoses, not in a way to end my life, but I think as a form of self-harm, and I think also as a way just to kind of, like, blot things out for an evening. Like, it's almost like I just wanted to find a way to, like, sleep for a few days. So that ended up being the first time I was in hospital.
To dwell on that for a moment, that's really people's worst nightmare. You know, being in hospital for anything over Christmas.
Yeah, it was quite bizarre because, yeah, it was over Christmas. It was just like, especially on Christmas Day, it was really nice. And my parents came up to see me and it was great. So they like brought presents and stuff. So we're still able to have like a bit of Christmas on the hospital ward. But it was like very surreal because nobody's happy to be on a psychiatric ward on Christmas Day.
Yeah, even the doctors, they don't want to be there either.
They don't want to be there. Like, they were really good about trying to throw a bit of a Christmas party, and we had hospital Christmas dinner, which was passable. But, yeah, so they did try to kind of make it like a nice little party and to make a Christmassy atmosphere. But, yeah, it wasn't exactly what I wanted to be.
Okay, and so it's interesting as well what you mentioned of the GP earlier, that you needed, it sounds almost like you needed an authority figure to sort of cut through all the confusion of the time and just give you an answer and say, this is what you need to do. I'm interested to know, at the same time, were you given any kind of initial diagnosis that gave you any clarity as well?
At the time, not really. I was still just kind of labelled under the depression anxiety kind of umbrella at this point. And I think when, over that Christmas as well, when I was in hospital, they were still a bit confused as well. I think because, well, I was clearly like very depressed and having a lot of anxiety. But then also I was having these weird thoughts, which were kind of like bordering on a psychosis. Mm-hmm. But then the problems with eating as well. I remember a nurse coming to talk to me and it was kind of quite obvious that she was trying to work out if I had an eating disorder or not, because when I got there, I like most of like the hospital food, like I couldn't eat because it would be the wrong color, and I would just like panic at meal times and kind of wouldn't touch much. So I think they didn't really know what was going on at that point. I'm trying to think when it was. It's quite a while before I was given a borderline personality disorder diagnosis.
Yeah, which is common in and of itself as well. When you had that real range of symptoms, I can see how the doctors were struggling to pin it down.
Yeah, I think there's so much overlap as well that it's so difficult when it comes to putting a label on it. I feel like at the end of the day, when it comes to treatment, what should matter is that you're getting the treatment that fits your symptoms. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem, I think particularly for BPD, is that there's dialectical behaviour therapy, like DBT, which is kind of seen as like the gold standard treatment, but you can only be referred for that in the NHS if you have the BPD diagnosis, which I think is a massive shame because it's something which could be helpful. Like, I'm honestly of the belief that like everybody could learn DBT because it's a lot of it is just sort of like almost like basic life skills, but it's like you need somebody to tell you about it before it clicks. Mm-hmm. But it's like you need that label before you can even be put on a waiting list.
Yeah, it's interesting the way you've described it. It reminds me of like quotes. As soon as you hear it, it makes instant sense to you, but you may never have thought of phrasing it in that way. I definitely agree with you. I think counselling in general, it can benefit everyone. And that definitely is one of the debates that goes on in terms of how our NHS is structured, because at the moment it is very diagnosis focused. It creates more of this separation of which one do you have, whereas actually there is a lot of crossover. And there's been many people I've spoken to through doing the podcast who have had diagnoses like depression and anxiety early on, and then have had something later, like BPD or like bipolar, things that are generally diagnosed later on. And then the first two diagnoses are abandoned. And then they're in this position of, well, those two seem to fit me too. So where does that leave me? It's almost like there's this hierarchy of certain ones almost cancel out previous diagnoses, which is quite odd from a outside of medical perspective like mine.
And I think as well, it's frustrating because, I mean, I think I'm in quite a good position that I can see it from both sides, that on the one hand, there are such limited resources that you have to find some way to prioritize people. Mm-hmm. But at the minute, it means that there's no like preventative treatment. It's all, it's almost like you have to reach a crisis point before you're considered and well enough to even be put on the waiting list in some cases, which is just like the total opposite of how anything else would be treated. It's like, like there's just such a strong emphasis, like particularly at the minute, on a cardiovascular placement, and everything there is about trying to get like preventative measures, so like stopping smoking, healthy diet, stuff like that. But then in mental health, like I feel like a lot of that is just ignored, and they wait until you're at crisis point and then try to fix it going backwards.
Absolutely. And for most people, and I think this comes back to the core of the episode of like student mental health, because for so many people, it's not until they get to university and they're away from their usual like family support system. Yeah. They're often away from, you know, home and where they grew up. And in most cases, they don't have much insight into what mental health / mental illness is. And yeah. So is it really a surprise that then with all those life changes going on, they can reach a crisis point?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they're not equipped to have the insight going into it. You know, you have to wait until you've got the diagnosis and then someone explains to you what is going on.
That's so true. And I think from other people who I've spoken to as well, who've been in a similar position, it just seems that everybody has like the same kind of story, where at first they had no idea what was going on. And I think by the whole nature of a mental illness as well, is that you do kind of lose insight as you become more unwell. So it makes it even harder to get help, because you're almost doubting whether there's anything wrong and thinking, is this just how everybody feels? Like, is this just normal? Like, I feel like it is. You just don't realize that there is something wrong almost until it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting what you talked about earlier of how looking back post-diagnosis, you started to notice things in your life. Because I had the exact same experience. And I think growing up, I took a lot of depressive symptoms as normal, because no one was talking about it. And I just assumed everyone was feeling it, but not talking about it. And then actually, you know, looking back post-diagnosis, you're like, oh, actually, you know, that time when I had a birthday party and I was only little and I purposely tried to be happy rather than just automatically being a happy kid, you know, you start to pick up on scenarios like that and be like, that makes more sense now.
And I think especially I can really relate to that with when I first came up to uni as well, with a lot of the kind of partying and stuff. There would be nights where I just wasn't enjoying myself at all, but it's what you're supposed to do. So I would just still get really drunk and stay up until like 4 a.m. thinking, oh, everybody else is like enjoying it, so I should be enjoying it too. And you kind of get into this cycle of doing things, not because it's what you want to do, but because it's what you think other people expect you to do.
Yeah, it's that expectation. And the irony is there could be plenty of other people feeling the exact same way. But they'll look at you and they'll be like, oh, well, Jenny's having a great time.
So yeah, exactly.
Maybe I'm just in a bad mood. You know, they start questioning themselves.
It's actually really interesting you said that, because it was in, so every year in my course, you have to do like a little group project, which can be on anything you want that's medicine related. And in my second year, me and a group of friends who, some of them had also had problems with depression and anxiety, we decided to get together and basically send out questionnaires to all the med students at Edinburgh and ask them about like their opinions on mental health problems and their sort of attitudes in their own mental health. And one thing that we found was the amount of people who, they just had completely different opinions of kind of their own well-being versus other people's. And one of the questions we asked was, what would you advise your friend to do if they were struggling with their mental health? Mm-hmm. And they would all kind of say like, oh, like speak to them, offer to take them to the GP, like speak to their personal tutor. But then when it came to what they would do if they thought they were struggling with their mental health, a lot of like the majority of students just said like, oh, I'd probably just leave it or try to ignore it. Something which I'm still guilty of now, even though I feel like I have a lot of insight, is I'll have these double standards where it's something that if somebody else was experiencing the same thing, I would probably give them a lot better advice than what I would do myself. I feel like I'd be more likely just to sit on it and leave it.
Yeah, I think in a way that's how we're brought up, that with this kind of a binary idea of health, like you're healthy or you're not, you need to see the doctor or you don't. And often mental health comes at an in-between in a way that physical health doesn't.
Yeah. You know,
I remember growing up, plenty of people would break their arm. Luckily, it never happened to me, but it's quite a common kid experience. And so they go to the hospital, let it get bandaged up. And it was still healing, but they were back to normal life. They didn't need to see the doctor anymore. And in contrast, mental illness isn't like that. You know, you may not be at the doctor this week or next week, but that doesn't mean you don't still need medication. It doesn't mean you don't need ongoing self-care. You may still need counselling. There's all these other factors that need to be considered.
I think as well, when people say the word mental health, I think a lot of people see that as being synonymous with mental illness as well. But it's something, it's like if you put it in terms of like physical health, everybody has it, whether it's good or bad, and it fluctuates throughout your life. I think it's the same with mental health. Like, nobody has good mental health 100% of the time. Like, we all go through like bereavements or breakups or like exams and stressful life events. And it's not to say that at one point, maybe you do need some counselling or like medication for a little while, but then that doesn't mean you're going to be unwell forever either. It could be something that's quite transient. There's been a few times I can look back on as well where I've thought like, I've been feeling bad and I'm considering either going to my GP or phoning like a crisis line. And I just sit there thinking, but is it bad enough? And I think especially the crisis line, I'll be like, oh, but like, what if somebody else needs it more and I'm taking up the time? And you end up really like downplaying it and being like, oh, but it could be worse. Like, and you convince yourself not to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so, so common. I used to work for Samaritans and I worked with Nightline before that, which is, of course, roughly the student equivalent of Samaritans. And that was something that almost every call I took, it seemed really universal that people would apologize for using the service. And there were times where I spoke to people and I was like, I am here in the middle of the night. I've come in especially to take your calls. That's the only reason I'm here. I'm not here to eat biscuits, although they always have a great supply. I'm here to listen to you. You know, it's great that you've called. You know, that's what we're here for. And sometimes it took actually explaining it like that for people to be like, oh, right, okay, I do deserve the support.
Yeah, because that's something that I've definitely done as well, where I'll be like, sorry to bother you, even though that's literally what they're there for, like...
Yeah, and it's really sad because it can be so hard for people to get the support. The last thing I want you to feel is that you don't deserve it or that you're wasting anyone's time. You know, there is actually so much support out there that people can seek. And, you know, I hope through doing things like the podcast, having these conversations, people feel more empowered. You know, when they can hear us discuss it and be like, oh, right. They're having that same experience. They have all this insight, yet they can still feel guilty calling a support line.
Yeah, and I definitely find it really useful hearing other people's experiences. And I think one in particular, when it's probably one of like the first books I read, Reasons to Stay Alive by Matt Haig, that was it.
Okay.
And just the way he describes depression is just so relatable. And there's a bit where he talks about being hungry. Normally you would just get up and make a sandwich, but when you're depressed, you're lying in bed and thinking, I've got to get out of bed, I've got to walk to the kitchen, I've got to get a knife out, I've got to get a plate out. And you end up breaking it into so many points that eventually you're like, oh, I'll just stay in bed, like I won't bother. And that just resonated with me so well, just having somebody to word it like that and to be able to connect with him and realize that like there are other people who feel exactly the same.
That's a great recommendation. I haven't read it yet myself, but it's like,
it's so good.
From doing this show, Audible obviously has me sussed because it's constantly recommending mental health books. So you've talked about, you know, getting that initial diagnosis, having the support over summer. It's great that you felt able to go back into your second year. What was the kind of response from my peers? You know, did you feel comfortable opening up about what was going on?
At that point, my close friends knew, and I felt quite open to talk to them. What actually helped me to speak about it a lot more was when I got involved with See Me Scotland. Mm-hmm. And it was just by chance, I just went to a day that they had where it was just kind of running some ideas kind of by young people, kind of aged 16 to 25. And from there, I ended up going on like a residential away trip and ended up being involved for several years.
And just for the listeners, could you introduce a bit of what See Me Scotland does?
Yeah, so See Me Scotland are a mental health anti-stigma charity. So they do campaigns, a lot of media campaigns on the Young People's Programme that have been most involved in. We've been doing a lot of work in schools to try and teach high school students in Scotland just about mental health and to know what the signs are and what signs are in friends and knowing how to signpost each other to different people and organisations that can help as well. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I think, through some of the media volunteering that I did, it was really helpful to kind of introduce me to, as opposed to being more open about it and being able to actually see how much of a difference it makes to be able to talk about it and also to be able to meet other people who've been through the same thing. And the other volunteers are like all amazing as well. And it's just so good to have that big group of people, because I think a lot of the time when you talk about mental health very openly to people and kind of conversationally, sometimes people don't know how to react and will kind of go a bit silent, not knowing whether to joke back or not. I think especially, I mean, I've got quite a dark sense of humour anyway, quite often people will just sort of go silent or not know how to react. But I think it's something which, even though it's a serious subject, I think that just trying to make it into a more normal conversation subject, it just gets people talking. And once you do, I think I find a lot that once you share your own experience, other people will be like, oh yeah, like I've also struggled with depression or anxiety too. And it is, it's just about normalizing it and getting other people to open up. And you realize that so many people struggle with their mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you say there about being lighthearted about it, joking about mental illness, it can be such a useful technique because it's not diminishing to any extent, you know, how devastating it can be. It's a bit of taking back the power, you know, that you've got through certain things and you can point them out and you can laugh. And it's taking ownership of those things and sort of in a funny sort of way, putting them in their place. You're a thing I have, you're not a thing I am.
Yeah.
So you did take some time out as well. Could you talk us through
that? So this was a couple of years on now, and I've been trundling along, getting by, and at this point I was on like a fairly good sort of medication regime, and I'd been seeing like a community mental health nurse, and getting like some therapy that way. But it was in my fourth year, it was, again, it's quite weird looking back on it because I think my memory has just got really hazy around it. Mm-hmm. I think partly because as a way of coping, I think I was coping by partying too much in that. I think it's something at uni is really easy to do, is to just kind of bounce around friendship groups, going out every night and just getting absolutely bladdered, and nobody thinks anything of it. They're just like, oh, they're a party animal, they're out every night. They don't see it as like actually she's like drinking herself into oblivion every night. And that, so I feel like that's partly why my memory is very hazy. But then I think it all just kind of blurs into one, because I was just in such, I think, just quite like a deep depression, and I was struggling to keep on top of uni. And I was also at this point trying to be involved with like loads of societies as well. So I was just bouncing between everything, had way too much on my plate and just couldn't cope with it all. And it got to a point where I think it was after Christmas at some point in fourth year, where I was called to a meeting, and there's, it was called the Professional Development Committee, and it's basically a committee to kind of look after med students and kind of make sure that they're doing okay and coping okay and sort of meeting the standards that I needed to get through medical school. And honestly, looking back, I can't remember why the meeting was called or what had like alerted them to it, but they basically called me in and said that like I wasn't well enough to be on the wards anymore. And at the time I was self-harming really bad. So I was in and out of A&E constantly. So I think it must actually have been that someone from A&E had alerted them, because they had it down as a medical student and they need to make sure it's not a fitness practice issue. They told me I wasn't well enough to study. And I just remember walking out of the building in a complete daze, just like, what has happened? And I think I was still in denial at that point, because I remember going home and instantly going on the internet and searching for jobs, which in hindsight is completely ridiculous, because I'd been told I wasn't well enough to study. And then I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get a full-time job. And that just didn't go well either. Again, the timeline just gets really hazy here, but there was a period of time where I had a part-time job at Starbucks and was also kind of supplementing that with receiving benefits as well. So I think at that point I realized I just could not cope with working full time. And that was a hassle in itself, because trying to claim benefits for a mental illness, I think a lot of the time they just like don't believe, they don't see it as something that can be classed as a disability. And I think as well, nobody likes to think of themselves as being disabled. So I found it quite awkward, because you're having to fill out a form saying, I can't do this, I can't do that.
And again, it can feed back into that same work, self-worth thing of, yeah, am I worth this kind of support, right?
Yeah, and I would be thinking like, oh, well, are there people who need it more? Maybe I don't deserve it. I should just get a full-time job. Like, I should just be, I think that was it. A lot of the time I think I should be able to cope. Like, I should be able to do this. And at some point, I ended up back in hospital again, because I'd been self-harming really bad. There were like a few times where I was like rushed into hospital. I remember one time I'd been discharged from the hospital for self-harm, and the next morning I just went to my GP and kind of said like I need to be admitted to the psychiatric hospital, because I felt like I just couldn't stop myself. Self-harm had become such an addiction, mm-hmm. and it just got so out of control. And I feel like that time I wanted better care, like, because I was genuinely afraid that I would end up just killing myself, almost like killing myself accidentally rather than being suicidal.
And I'm interested to just pause there on self-harm, because it's not something we've really covered on the podcast before, and I think unless you have experience of it, it's not something that most people understand what the motivation is. Would you mind just talking through from your perspective kind of what was going through your head when you were self-harming?
Because I remember as well, when I was a teenager, even like in the news, there would be stories about like, is your child self-harming? And it would be the kind of thing that everyone would joke about. And if someone thought somebody else at school was self-harming, it would be like a rumor, like, oh, they're self-harming, and they get made fun of for it. And it's not something that I
That's terrifying.
Yeah, and I was guilty of it as well, but I would see self-harm as always being a joke, and I'd be like, oh, it's just attention seeking, and never thought it's something that I would go through. And it was, I don't even remember how it started, to be honest. Like, I just have a vague memory of it basically being almost like I didn't know what else to do, so I might as well try self-harm. which sounds just really stupid, but I think it was. I was just so desperate to find anything that would work, and knowing that some people had self-harmed, I did just sort of think, like, what the hell, maybe it will work. But
and when you say work, you mean like alleviate how you're feeling?
Yeah, to kind of just relieve, I guess, the intensity of the emotions. And I suppose, like, in some ways it would do that, but it becomes so addictive, and it's like, okay, in the short term it might make you feel a bit better, but all you've actually done is added something else to feel bad about. So it would work for a few minutes, and then you're like, oh, like, I've self-harmed again, and start feeling bad about that. And then you get into the secrecy part as well, where you're like, okay, now I've got to hide this. Now I've, like, and later on you're like, oh, I've done permanent damage, and it just spirals into something else that you just feel really crap about and you give yourself a hard time about. But it becomes so addictive that I think it's really hard to stop, and it becomes almost like a habit as well, where to start with it was something that I would do if I felt like I needed to get a relief, but then later on it was just habitual. It was almost like a nighttime routine where it's like, take my makeup off, yeah, like, get into pajamas, self-harm, go to bed. Before you know it, it's just spiraled out of control, and I would just feel like I couldn't not do it. It was just became a compulsion in the end.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that very much mirrors what I was thinking when you were describing it, of this weird sort of routine or cycle where you're doing it, and then as a result you have to cover it up, and then that can make you feel worse or more isolated because you're keeping more secrets.
Yeah.
And so it sort of cycles in this way. Yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing that with me, because it's so tough. I've never been that bad. In fact, in many ways, the kind of self-harming I've done in the past is quite niche. So when I was at uni and I was really struggling, I had this thing of, I used to like itch my skin, and I don't even know how it started, but I think it was in a similar way. It was a kind of distraction, you know, like I was feeling all these things, and there were days when I wouldn't go out, and I, you know, wasn't eating right. And at that point I didn't know I had issues around food yet. But, you know, I really, really just wasn't looking after myself at all. And it became, I think, in a way, this sort of distraction of what was going on up here in my head to, you know, a physical sensation that was a distraction. So I used to, like, scratch, like, around my wrist or, like, the back of my hand. And the only time I'd ever seen that before was, like, Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. That was, like, the only other time I'd really seen that portrayed. But it became very quickly a kind of compulsion, and I'd see the kind of the scabbing, and, you know, I'd see the kind of layers of skin like being damaged, but I'd still continue, and it became this thing I'd, you know, constantly like check on and sort of monitor what was going on around my hands and, you know, add to it. And it became this thing where I couldn't really explain at the time what I was doing or why I was doing it. I just knew that it was something I needed to hide because other people would be worried. And I knew that it wasn't normal. And I, to a certain extent, looking back on it now, I wonder if that's why cutting is such a common form of self-harm, in that it's possibly the one that's the best known, whereas actually there's so many different types, and some of them are, you know, disorders in and of themselves. And, you know, luckily when I got the support and I, you know, left uni, that really did stop almost suddenly.
Yeah, and I think it's really true what you were saying, as I think because cutting is the most commonly known one, I think that's why that's what it started out with for me, is because I'd heard about it and thought, like, maybe it would work. I think as well, I kind of want to clarify that by saying that I'm not kind of thinking that kind of it's by talking about it gives suggestions to other people, but I mean, people have been self-harming since way before the internet. And so, I mean, even like you were saying with Miss Havisham, like, even going back to like that far when that was written, like, self-harm was still like really common. It was just a lot more hidden, and Yeah, I think that part of the issue with self-harm is I think a lot of the methods that I use kind of go unnoticed because it's not seen as the kind of classic self-harm.
Yeah, I would agree. It's definitely something that can go unnoticed so much. And we've only mentioned a few, but there's so many ways in which people can self-harm, and certain conditions like eating disorders can have elements of that in there as well. But, you know, obviously, I feel the need to insert a disclaimer here that it doesn't actually help. You know, it creates other problems in and of itself. So as much as it can be a distraction in some way for some people, it doesn't actually alleviate what's really going on. It doesn't provide any kind of fix for what you're going through emotionally. It even still, it adds a physical layer that is the last thing you need. I guess the best way I'd sort of sum up where it fits is that it's kind of like the opposite to self-care. You know, when we really push on the podcast, self-care and all these things you can do to look after your body and look after your mind, and this is the opposite end of that spectrum. That's where self-harm fits. You know, I hope it's something that listeners can feel empowered to talk about, but it's always something to seek support on. It's not something to leave and think will be okay.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as well, at the time, you don't think about the long-term consequences as well. I think, I'm thinking kind of particularly about things which kind of cause lasting physical damage. Something that I sort of never would think when I was self-harm is little things like going to the beach or kind of wearing like shorts in summer. And it's something where, since I've like stopped self-harming and have kind of got more confident and the scars have faded a bit, I think I care about that less, and sort of I will go out. I mean, I went on holiday over summer and I did kind of wear like swimwear, but this at the back of my mind, like, I know that some people are going to look at it and think like, oh, like she's been self-harming, and there will be people who will have negative reactions, and there are still times where I do feel self-conscious, and so it's definitely not something which has ever solved any problem for more than 5 minutes before it just makes things much worse.
Then we kind of went into that off the back of talking about where you were when leaving uni. So in contrast, now we're lucky to be speaking to you just after you've gone back to uni for the first time, having had 2 years away. And so can you talk a little bit about, you know, how that 2 years has been in terms of getting you ready for going back to uni and how the experience is of uni in contrast now?
Yeah, so I think at first, I think initially it was a big downward spiral. And I think a lot of that was the feeling of having just completely lost control and having had somebody else make the decision, to say that I had to leave. I just saw it as a failure. I've always been someone who's been really driven, and I've always had sort of several things on the go, and to suddenly find myself not in uni at that point, not knowing if I'd be able to go back, kind of struggling to even cope with a part-time job. I think I was only working about 10 hours a week, but I was struggling to even cope with that. It just felt like I'd kind of lost who I was, and it just fed into like a massive downward spiral. And for a good few months, I was kind of bouncing between the intensive home treatment team and then back in hospital and then back to the intensive home treatment team. But kind of fortunately, in a way, I'd moved flats, which put me in a new catchment area for GPs. And with being in the new catchment area, I also changed to a new mental health team, which is a bit frustrating because essentially it comes down to where you live. It's not something you can control. But the team who I'm still with now are just much more cohesive, and everyone on it would kind of actually just communicate with each other. And so they'd all know what each other was doing in regards to my care. And that was the point where the psychiatrist who I saw kind of sat down and just had a rethink about my medication. Because at that point, each time I was put in hospital or seen a new psychiatrist, they would jiggle things around and kind of add things and slightly take things away. So I was on a huge amount of medication that wasn't really, like, doing much. It was a bit pointless. So he was able to kind of just think about it clearly, get rid of what was unnecessary, adjust the doses of what was. And I think, importantly, he referred me for DBT as well. And while I was on the waiting list for that, I was also seeing a mental health nurse, but also an occupational therapist. And I think occupational therapy for mental health problems is so underrated, because at that point I was struggling to be motivated to do anything. I'd quit the job at Starbucks because I felt like I couldn't cope with it and that I wasn't good enough for it, so I just quit. I was just feeling totally lost, didn't have anything to do with my day, so I was just sat at home, like, ruminating on everything. Mm-hmm. But she helped me to create some structure in my week, even down to little things like going for a walk every day, or even just getting up and getting dressed, even if I don't leave the flat, and helping me to get into volunteering so that I had a purpose again and a reason to get up and get dressed and to meet new people and to just have human contact regularly.
Yeah.
So that was a huge help while I was waiting for DBT. And then finally, about a year down the line, I finally got to the head of the waiting list for DBT. And that has honestly been a life changer. It's a year-long course. You have a weekly group session and then an individual session as well. And the group session is where they teach you, like, the core skills. And then over the week, you kind of practice these core skills and you do, like, a daily mood diary and write if you used any skills and if you used any sort of negative behaviors, and you can talk it over individually. Mm-hmm. That particularly for BPD is really useful because they teach you things like emotional regulation and how to navigate relationships and also some key crisis skills. And something which I think I really struggled with at first is they're very much say, like, okay, like, at the end of the day, like, it's your responsibility to work hard and to get better. Whereas I think when you're really unwell, it's easy to think, like, I just want someone else to fix it. But they're very clear from the start to be like, we can't fix it, you need to put in the work. So it's really intense and there's a lot of work each week. But I feel like even though I still get, like, the intense emotions, I'm much better at being able to cope with them and manage them, and also kind of knowing how to express them as well, instead of just sort of bottling up and trying to ignore it.
Right.
I still have a couple months of the individual sessions left, so it's quite a nice transition back into university for me. But I think without that, I think I'd still be stuck in quite a few of the kind of harmful behaviors that I got into, like the self-harm, instead of having healthy ways to kind of cope with the emotions and to know how to cope with, like, conflict as well.
Yeah. And so now you're back at uni, you've been back for about a month, right?
Yeah, I've been back for about a month now. And before I started, I was so nervous, not about that I've had such a long break from the learning, but I was just so worried about making friends, knowing that everybody who was there would already have known each other for 4 years and have their set friendship groups. And I was just terrified that I would be, like, the older student who's come in and doesn't know anybody and just sits on her own at lunchtime. And I was just so worried. I was just so worried that I'd be lonely. But everyone was so nice. And just on the first day of lectures, I just went in and sat down with some random people and just said, like, hi, I'm Jenny. Yeah, everyone was just, like, so welcoming, and I have friends, which is good. But I think, yeah, having the DBT skills has really helped me to manage my time, which I think is really important. To be a bit more assertive as well, and to know when to say no. So to not take on loads of extra projects, not go on a night out when I have to be up early the next morning, mm-hmm. and just to know my limitations as well.
Yeah, no, that's really great to hear. It's nice as well that I'm getting to talk to you now when you have that contrast and you've gone back to uni having gone through all these ups and downs. Is there anything, just to round up before we finish, is there anything that you would really recommend if someone listening to this is really relating to it and they're struggling with their mental health while they're at uni?
I think it is about finding the right help. And the problem is it can be so variable depending on where you're studying and where you live. But GPs are fantastic at knowing what local resources there are. And there are people who have bad experiences, but I would say if you do go to a GP and they're quite dismissive, you have the right to go back and ask to see a different GP. Yeah. Or even at the extreme end, to swap GP practices and see somebody else. And I'd say also uni counselling services are really good as well at looking at student-specific problems. So I think it's quite common for people to see exam stress as something that's not serious enough to get help for. But especially at uni, the counselling services see that all the time, and they have like really good resources and are really good at helping you to put in practical coping strategies for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'll just add on to that myself, as we mentioned it, Nightline is a really brilliant service geared especially to universities, where in most cases it's other students choose to stay up and do shifts at all hours, so that if there's no one else you feel you can call Nightline and someone will listen to you, and they'll most likely understand what you're going through. They'll specifically understand these university problems because, you know, they may have experienced them themselves, or they will have talked to other people that night that have. So most unis do have a Nightline service. And so you can find out more details about that and the links on our website as well, mentalpodcast.co.uk. And then we'll just round up before we finish then. You had a few things you wanted to kind of mention.
The first one, I would just really recommend checking out See Me Scotland, even if you don't live in Scotland, because they have great resources that you can use to help tackle stigma, resources for schools as well. The second one I'd love to give a little shout out to is Tea and Empathy. So they're a Facebook page for medical professionals, including students. And it's a peer support group set up in memory of a doctor who ended her own life. And it's just a way to kind of rant about the kind of specific problems that are experienced by people in healthcare and to get advice on how to care for your own mental health in the job.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for being part of the show.
Hey, thank you for inviting me.
Our petition to get mental health education onto the curriculum for all schools is continuing to gather momentum, and the Department for Education has now put forward initial plans on how to make this happen. If this petition is something you'd like to learn more about and hopefully sign it and share it as well, you can find out more at bit.ly/mentalpetition. The link for that is also in the description. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.